The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
By the time Rheticus arrived, which was 1539, Copernicus was decades past having fathered this alternate universe, but he had not published his book.
Historian Davis O'Bell is best known for her brilliant best-selling book Longitude, a history of Harrison's clock and its role in maritime exploration. She's now back with a new story shining a light on the early days of modern astronomy. Specifically, how Copernicus ended up publishing his radical view that the Earth went round the Sun and not the other way round. We have an extended interview with Deva coming up. And we'll look at some of the surprising new twists in the story of human evolution and examine the results of a poll that show whether or not Britons have been scared off nuclear power after the recent accident at Fukushima. The Guardian's Ian Sample will be here to discuss both those stories. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. We're going to start this week straight with the news. And by the way, me and Ian thought it would be great to give you a bit of a vocal show by developing head colds this week. Ian Sample's in the studio with us now to talk about this week's news stories. Now, I'm going to read one of Ian's more tender stories, and I'm going to read the first paragraph, and he can then take it up from there. It goes like this. I don't know if we can have any sound effects or if we can afford any. It was a traumatic and lingering death. The adult female and young male probably fell through a fissure in a cave roof, and after surviving the fall, stayed alive for days or weeks, with little or no food, before finally meeting their end. The pair, possibly a mother and her son, were then washed by a rainstorm into an underground pool, where they were gradually solidified into rock. Now, Ian, when did you start writing fiction? What was your sort of first thing?
Sorry, my brain really is mush. I can't respond to anything of that level of wit.
It's really a very low level of wit.
No, I know. It's not much, is it? So this was a series of papers published in Science last week, which really give the first detailed and comprehensive analysis of some skeletons, some fossilized skeletons that were unearthed in a cave in near Johannesburg in 2008. They were announced in 2010, but this is the first really sort of detailed look through some of that species anatomy. And at the time, it was considered last year, it was considered that this was possibly a new sort of species, a new branch maybe of the human family tree. Say they date back to about 2 million years old. The interesting thing out of these five papers that have just come out is that the authors use those papers really to set out a stall and argue that this was, in their view, the best candidate yet for an immediate ancestor of Homo erectus, which puts it directly in our own modern human lineage.
This slightly over-the-top intro with the mother and son dying in a cave, in that cave alongside them were all sorts of other creatures. It seems like it was a sort of menagerie in there of woodland antelope, it says here, saber-toothed cats, hyenas. What was the area like? Where were they?
Well, at the time, this the area, and you can tell some of this by looking at the kinds of creatures and also the plant life that was around. And
it's worth saying where they were found.
Sorry, it's 40 miles outside Johannesburg is where this it's called the Malapa Cave Network, and this was a subterranean cave where these guys are thought to have fallen through the roof at the time, and with a bunch of other animals. And what you found below, caught in this in the sediments is just a real death trap, historical death trap. You've got some of these species that you just mentioned back there, but they're all there together, and a lot of these seem to have fallen a long way and been seriously injured and died shortly after getting into the cave.
So what have the analyses shown about these fossils? What do we know about this particular species?
Well, Lee Berger at the University of Witwatersrand, which I may well have pronounced wrongly, in Johannesburg, who leads this team, he's a paleoanthropologist, and he speaks incredibly enthusiastically about these remains, and, you know, for good reason. They are very complete. They've got A beautiful, beautifully preserved skull. They've got, you know, lots and lots of the bones, and they haven't even started digging. A lot of this stuff is, you know, material they're pulling off the surface for the time being. And these are, you know, the most complete, I'd say, and well-preserved hominid remains from this period, from around 2 million years old. And what's interesting about them, one of the things that's interesting about them is it fills in a bit of a gap between Lucy, you know, the another sort of primitive species that may have been in the human line that dates back to about 3.2 million years ago. And her remains were uncovered in Ethiopia in 1974. And Homo erectus, which is our immediate ancestor, which died out about 1.3 million years ago. And it's, you know, that we don't have much there to tell us what went on in our human lineage. What really matters from these papers, though, is that taken together, you look at this species, and they call it Australopithecus sediba. It looks, the authors argue, very much like an early, you know, direct forerunner of Homo erectus. It has some traits which look very human. It also has some which look very far more ancient than that, and we can go through those.
Well, I was going to say the size of the brain is interesting, isn't it? It seems to have expanded brain case to allow it to do things like long-term, well, the authors claim to allow it to do things like reasoning, long-term planning. I mean, that sounds very human.
Yeah, and so if you think of Lucy as being about a meter tall, these guys were about 1.3 meters tall. You're starting to get into the lower range of sort of modern human heights. But given the size of this creature, and it walked on two legs, it was a bipedal, it had a very small brain, 420 cubic centimeters. It's not very big, and you would imagine not very clever. And you can argue that because its brain is so small, it wouldn't be able to do things like use tools in any particular way. But when they scanned the brain case, and they did this at ESRF, the synchrotron out in Grenoble, when you scan the skull and you can look at the deformation on the inside of the skull caused by the brain, you can look at the shapes and get an idea of the actual shape of the brain. And the frontal lobes show a reorganization from a more primitive structure towards a more modern human brain structure. And it shows these expansions, this growing of these particular areas in the frontal lobes, which are really associated with this sort of more technical, high-level thinking.
All right, well, let's fast forward 2 million years from ancestors of humans, possibly, to one of the disasters that happened earlier this year, a natural disaster off the coast of Japan, obviously the earthquake and tsunami that hit that country, thousands and thousands of people died, and one of the things that is the enduring reminder of that was the Fukushima nuclear accident. This was where the actual power plants, several of the cores went into meltdown. There was all sorts of problems with evacuations around there and so on. And it was a really, really sort of slightly worrying time. The biggest nuclear accident since Chernobyl in 1986. And many people around the world, you know, sort of quietly were worried, is this going to be the death knell for the nuclear industry? Nuclear power, for some people, is seen as one of the most important sources of energy when it comes to providing electricity in the future that doesn't emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So, you know, if this was going to be a real issue, then it's a problem for global climate change targets. So the question is, after several months after that, the situation is not stable by any means in Japan, but is the world scared of nuclear power? Or at least is Britain scared of nuclear power? Because it's a big plank of our future electricity needs. So what has happened is that the British Science Association, which starts its festival, or has started its festival by the time you're listening to this, commissioned a polling company, Populus, to ask 2,000 people what they thought of nuclear power, whether they supported it, and so on, and looked at how it differed to this time last year. And of course, if it's going down, then that's a problem. And what they did find was that 41% of the respondents agreed that the benefits of nuclear power outweighed the risks. And that was actually up from 38% this time in 2010. The poll was done, by the way, in at the end of August. So, you know, several months after the Fukushima accident. And those people who thought that the risks greatly or even slightly outweighed the benefits of nuclear power. In 2010, there was 36% of people thought that. And in 2011, that dropped to 28%. I mean, Ian, it's interesting that despite the biggest nuclear accident, huge amounts of coverage, some would say over the top sensational coverage, that it seems that the British public have sort of been a bit more sensible about the way they actually responded to it.
Yeah, and it's hard to know from this survey whether and how much Fukushima had an impact on their thinking on that. I mean, I can't personally say that it's had much sort of impact on how I feel about nuclear.
Well, I guess it's more that if you see this stuff happening somewhere in the world in a technologically advanced nation like Japan, if you see this stuff happening there, you think, well, hang on, it could happen here as well. And it's pretty bad. We've had to evacuate 100 kilometers or something all the way around. There's all this radiation everywhere. I mean, the facts aren't as terrifying as the perceptions, perhaps. The facts are that nobody yet has died from the radiation leak. There are other problems around how it happened. I mean, regulation has come up as a big problem in Japan. But it wasn't that the nuclear power itself was dangerous. I mean, that's the scary thing, isn't it? That it's not going to go wrong, but when it does, it could be potentially horrible.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, Fukushima is an enormous problem for Japan, but bear in mind, and the positives that I took from that, and I'm pretty sort of neutral on nuclear power. I think it certainly has some value, but this was a 40-year-old reactor design that took a direct hit from one of the largest earthquakes in the past century and easily one of the most powerful tsunamis. It was directly on the coast where the tsunami came in. It got completely inundated with water, absolutely trashed. You had 6 reactors running at the time. 3 of them closed down okay. 3 of them were running and did not close down okay and have caused serious problems. And there will be long-lasting issues from that. But to then transfer that experience and say, what can we learn from it? How should that affect us over, you know, in areas of the world where, to be fair, we're not on the ring of fire in that part of the world. We're not earthquake prone. We're not tsunami prone. You can work out scenarios whereby a nuclear installation over here could get a serious thump one way or another, whether it's, you know, from people trying to do it or from some sort of natural cause that you might cook up. But, you know, it really showed that even a 40-year-old design could withstand the worst that nature could throw at it.
Was it also interesting in the poll, if you dig into the data a little bit, is that there's a difference between men and women and their overall view of nuclear power. It seems that 53% of men are in favour of nuclear power, but only 21% of women. And apparently this is reflected around the world. And one of the authors, or not the authors, one of the psychologists from the University of Cardiff who was presenting this poll, actually said that it could be, this result could be something to do with the George Monbiot effect, he called it. And that was the comment piece that George wrote back in March or April, I think, just after the actual accident, saying exactly what you're just saying now, a 40-year-old design hit by 2 of the biggest natural disasters possible, and it's still not killed anyone in terms of the radiation. It's not been great, but it shows the robustness of those designs. And if the regulations had been followed properly, a lot of that wouldn't have even happened. And the psychologist was saying that this is a kind of a new discourse in the public domain in the last 5 months where women have remained relatively ambivalent or negative, and that men seem to be more confident that the world can't really throw anything technology, that can't be solved by technology. The other thing that they talked about at the launch was something interesting. I mean, we should come back to this in the future, perhaps, is future nuclear power, what will it look like? Is it going to be uranium-based? And there are many scientists are now arguing, no, it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be uranium-based because there are too many problems with the designs, even Generation 4 nuclear power stations. They still have too many chemical reactive components. They have too much high pressure in there. There's too many things that can go wrong. And so the guys here were pushing Bryony Worthington, who is a Labour peer and an environmental campaigner, a longtime friend of The Guardian. She is now a member of a new NGO which is trying to promote thorium-based nuclear power, which thorium is, for anyone who doesn't know, is a very common radioactive metal, and it's 4 times more common in the Earth's crust than uranium is. There's enough of it for 10,000 years of energy. And also, you don't need to build anywhere near as complex a power station as you would for uranium. It doesn't go critical in any sense. So as long as you're firing neutrons at your lump of thorium, it will produce heat, and you know, you can use that to produce energy, produce electricity rather. But as soon as you stop the neutron source, and that could be an accelerator or anything else, it just stops working. It just absolutely stops. It switches off like a light bulb.
I think one of the things that's important when it comes to weighing up the sort of pros and cons of different energy sources is, and it's made very stark by nuclear, is that I think it's a little bit unfair just to consider, say, after Chernobyl, how many people died. And the majority of people who died from the radiation from Chernobyl were children who developed thyroid cancers because they were not barred from drinking contaminated milk and such like. But you also have to bear in mind that on top of that, on top of the physically related deaths, you have an awful lot of people, and this is in Fukushima, around Fukushima and everywhere else, where these events like this happen. You have an awful lot of people who are affected by perceived danger, by the stress of the event. Obviously, the workers at TEPCO at Fukushima have been under immense physical and mental stress, but the populace around that, they, even if it comes from a misunderstanding of the real risks, they suffer.
Any industrial process, when it comes to energy generation, any industrial process will have deaths attached to it. And I think there's probably still more people who die from coal dust and down mines and that kind of thing than the total number of deaths, even the way you're suggesting, associated with nuclear power. I mean, as I said, it's a debate that we can have again another time. But thorium reactors are something that I think that because they've never been... The technology's there. It's easy to use, according to these guys at the Weinberg Foundation, which is this new NGO. But because it's never been, because you can't use it to produce plutonium and therefore atomic bombs, it was never been invested in, which is what their argument is. Well, that story is one of the first from the British Science Festival. And as you're listening to this now, we're going to be there in Bradford, lucky us, recording stuff for this podcast and beyond. So if you want to read all of that, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Davis O'Bell is a rare thing amongst historians and writers on science. With her book Longitude, she managed to pen a show-stopping worldwide bestseller. The story traced the drama at the heart of John Harrison's brilliant invention, a portable and reliable clock which allowed seafarers to measure longitude as they explored, travelled and mapped the world. In Davis' latest book, she turns from the mapping of the Earth to the story of the mapping of our cosmos. In A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos, she tells the story of the birth of modern astronomy. Welcome to the podcast. Can I start by just asking you to tell me who Nicolaus Copernicus was?
Yes, he was the son of a copper merchant, but was orphaned early on at age 10, and fortunately for him had a rich uncle who was in the employ of the Catholic Church and put him all the way through school and university and got him a position as a canon in the church. So in that role, he had to go to medical school and be a doctor. He was also expert in economics and advised the government on the dreadful state of the currency at that time. Currency seems to be always in a dreadful state. And he also he developed his interest in astronomy as a university student and began making observations at an early age. His extraordinary idea came out of a strict attention to the mathematics involved in predicting the positions of the planets. He was fascinated by that. And the prevailing ideas about the maths involved bothered him because they seemed to break a fundamental law of astronomy, namely that all the heavenly bodies should move with uniform motion in perfect circles.
Now, his extraordinary idea, for anyone not familiar with it, is the one that we all take for granted today, which is that the Earth actually goes around the Sun rather than the other way around.
And, exactly.
And no one had really mathematically worked this out before. To say it was a difficult idea to sort of get across, we'll come to that later, but okay. That was his idea. And You say he did it from observing the heavens. I mean, had people seen this idea before?
From observing the heavens, but also just from looking at the mathematics. When you observe the heavens, it certainly looks as though everything is in motion around the Earth. And there's no sensation of motion that you can feel, even though the Earth's motion is rapid. But when you try to make sense of the motions and you think about the vastness of the heavens, it's kind of crazy to expect all of that to be moving around the Earth, all the stars, every 24 hours. It strains belief. But if you have listened to common wisdom and your own common sense that you're not in motion, you'd rather think that all those things were moving around you. And there was religious support for the idea that the Earth was still. The Psalms talk about the firm foundation of the earth and that it's not to be moved forever. And of course, Joshua telling the sun to stand still, which he wouldn't have done if it had been standing still in the first place.
When was Copernicus working, and when were his ideas sort of coming to fore?
He was working in the very early 16th century, and by 1510, he had completely come up with his idea, enough so that he could summarize it in a letter to other mathematicians. And in that letter, copies of which still survive, he promises that he's working on a big book that will lay out all the mathematical foundation and explain everything.
Now, the way that history is normally discussed around this subject, Copernicus comes up with his ideas, Kepler comes up with the various laws of planetary motion. Galileo is the one that everyone has heard of that really publicizes this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then we all know now that Galileo was imprisoned in his own home by the Pope for a long time. But eventually the world came to its senses, and we now think the proper things about the way the Earth goes around the sun. Your book is focused on a specific point, though, before all of this. And it sort of tells a slightly different story of the history, in using a character called Rheticus. Now, tell us who he is.
He was a genius mathematician who was a student at Wittenberg, at Martin Luther's own university, and later taught mathematics on the faculty there. And he came from a difficult background. His father had been executed, beheaded, some say for sorcery, some say for theft, but he had been stripped of his name. So Rheticus is not the name he was born with. It's a name derived from the territory where he grew up in Russia. And he heard about Copernicus's work and sought him out. Rheticus was a serious astrologer. Probably Copernicus was not interested in astrology, but Rheticus was. And yes or no, you still needed to know the positions of the planets. So Rheticus made a very dangerous, lengthy journey all the way to northern Poland, to a town where Lutherans were banished by law. So the whole situation of their meeting was fraught. And that situation fascinated me. By the time Rheticus arrived, which was 1539, Copernicus was decades past having fathered this alternate universe, but he had not published his book, and he was frightened of publishing. He was frightened of being laughed at. He worried that certain religious authorities would take passages from the Bible and twist them to malign him, discredit him, and so he had just decided to keep it secret. But Rheticus talked him into publishing.
So the journey that Rheticus made was specifically designed to try and get Copernicus to make this stuff public.
Exactly.
What was in it for him? Why did Rheticus want to do that?
One reason was to share the joy of an arcane mathematical breakthrough, but because Rheticus believed so strongly in astrology, I feel it had a lot to do with him personally, with his own sense of knowing from his own chart that he had a very short life and he wanted to do something big while he still could. Of course, his predictions for his own lifespan were incorrect, and he wound up living a full life, but he didn't know that at the time.
As much of astrology is incorrect.
Yes, yes. Well, we can say that now.
We can say that now. But the interesting, well, the different thing about the way you tell the story is, rather than simply laying out the known facts of their meeting, you've got a two-act play in the middle of, right in the middle of your book.
Yes.
Which imagines what the interaction between these two characters we've talked about, Copernicus and Rheticus, might have been like. Now, before I get into what the content of that is, why did you choose that format? What was the tension you were trying to explore with that?
I found the fact that the two men came together over such almost insuperable differences a wonderfully dramatic situation. And when I first learned about their meeting and how their meeting led to the publication of that book, I thought right away that it would make a wonderful play. But that was a long time ago, and I didn't have the courage to attempt writing a play, even though I have a background in theater. Writing a play was another level of complication, and it took me the intervening years to work up the courage to do it.
And so the play itself is based around a few years of their work together.
I mean, their collaboration.
And Rheticus became a disciple, essentially, of Copernicus.
Yes, he was his only student, his only disciple.
And so what was it that, well, let's not spoil the play for people when they read it, but can you give us a sense of what their relationship was like and what kinds of things drew Copernicus out of this worried shell of his?
Yes, well, I pictured Copernicus as a reluctant individual, someone who would have the insight and the courage to reorganize the planets, but not be able to move himself in any social sphere. And so he resisted Rheticus's advances. And the way I imagined it, he tried to get rid of Rheticus immediately because harboring a Lutheran, Copernicus being in the church hierarchy himself, he couldn't really keep a Lutheran in that village, let alone in his own house. So I thought his immediate response would be to try to send him away. But somehow Rheticus would win him over, would say something about mathematics. And he brought Copernicus gifts of books from the finest scientific printer in Europe. And that was also a powerful influence to get his attention and win him over. And then, of course, they had their shared love of mathematical beauty, and that carried them over the hump. But none of the histories talk about how Copernicus managed to keep Rheticus in residence for about 2 years. So I thought, well, there must have been some kind of deal with the bishop. There was an early effort to get him out of town, but not too far away. So when Rheticus wrote his own summary of Copernicus's ideas after his first summer in residence, he says that he was sick when he arrived, and so his teacher took him away someplace to a neighboring diocese where there was a very kind bishop who let them stay with him for weeks. And I thought, so that was the hiding place.
Bit of intrigue there.
Yes.
How much poetic license did you take? I mean, as you're a historian, so in a sense, yes, this is kind of a different muscle to sort of use.
Yes, and it had no muscle at the beginning. It was very difficult to make things up.
How much would you allow yourself to sort of to write about things for which there might not be any documentary evidence?
Not at all at first. And the play was dreadfully dull. And it was only after I wrote the nonfiction narrative that I felt free to take license and let the characters fall in love or be impossible with each other. It was a freedom from knowing that I had done the right thing for them and telling what's known of their history, because no one knows what they said to each other. So you're required to make it up and to imagine it.
Why has Rheticus been, if not purposefully then, accidentally removed from the history of this great idea? I mean, I mentioned how I know it, and I expect most people wouldn't know that Rheticus was involved.
Well, he was certainly left out. He's not mentioned in Copernicus's book because the book was dedicated to the Pope, and Rheticus was, of course, the Lutheran. But he did get credit because he wrote a trial balloon summary that came out in September of 1539, so a few years before Copernicus's book. And when Copernicus saw that there was no terrible overreaction to that first report, he agreed to finish the book and had Rheticus stay and help him get the book into publishable form. But in subsequent printings of On the Revolutions, Rheticus's report was also printed with his name, and Kepler also printed Rheticus's report in one of his books. So probably people haven't heard of him, but he wasn't really written out of history. And there was a biography of him a few years ago. I'm not sure it was published here, but certainly I read it in America. It was called The First Copernican, and it was about Rheticus's life.
So once Copernicus's book was published, what happened next? I mean, how quickly did it become part of the establishment thinking, or at least how quickly did it start to challenge it?
Well, the first thing that happened was Copernicus died, so we never found out what the reaction was. And some of the earliest editions, copies of the book that still exist, show, by the way they are annotated by their owners and readers, that people really skipped over the first chapters, which talk about the rearrangement of the planets, and they went right to the heavy mathematics at the back. And that was what interested the mathematicians. The book was, of course, written in Latin, and it read like a textbook in spherical geometry and trigonometry. So it wasn't a book that average people could read. And there was, toward the end of the printing process, an anonymous preface inserted by the proofreader, warning people that nothing in the book should be taken too seriously, that it was really just about giving you a new way of thinking about calculations. And as far as that went, it was as good as any other and better than many.
That can't have been pleasing to the people who wrote it.
No, but then again, Copernicus had died.
He died, yeah.
So he didn't know about that. But it protected him from much outrage. Even so, there was a church censor who read it and took great umbrage and was about to cause a big fuss over it, but suddenly died. So nothing really happened until Galileo came along. And Kepler had read Copernicus and believed in him completely. And there's correspondence between Kepler and Galileo, and Kepler urging Galileo to step forward and support Copernicus, which Galileo was afraid to do until he made his first telescopic discoveries and had what he thought was evidence. Certainly he had evidence that there were bodies in motion around Jupiter, which made it easier to believe that only the moon was in motion around the Earth, and the Earth was actually in motion, carrying the moon along with it.
Galileo's is a completely different story.
Completely different story, because
just as fascinating.
He wrote in Italian, so he was pandering to a popular audience. That's what got the church so upset and angry and called the authorities down on him. And so he was silenced, and Copernicus's book, for the first time, was put on the index. And it couldn't really be banned because it was too valuable. It had actually figured in the correction of the calendar. But it was suspended until corrected. And a few years later, the church issued the necessary corrections, which mostly just took out language that suggested that Copernicus understood the structure of the universe, that it was just a thought. And somehow, even though the corrections had been issued, the book remained on the index, suspended until corrected, until the 19th century.
Now, are you going to try and use this same trick, if you like, of fictionalizing various points of history to in your future books? Did you think it works?
Dramatizing, yes. I had such a struggle learning to write a play that I'd hate to just leave it now that I've finally got the hang of it.
That was Dava Sobel. A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos, is published by Bloomsbury and is out now. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, at guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.